All right, thanks a lot. It's a great pleasure to be here to present our, well, results on our ongoing effort to use Tensor Networks. Is this okay? I hear myself fairly loud. It's okay? Yes, good. Our ongoing effort to use Tensor Networks to study strongly correlated systems, in particular topologically ordered systems. So this is a cross-section through a number of results we had in the recent years with many collaborators. So here in the room are Ignacio Sirac, Frank Fastrate, David Perez-Garcia, Didier Poblon, and also Shuo Yang. And there are also a number of other people who have participated in that. So the overall theme is that we would like to be able to describe topologically ordered systems in a way which is kind of resemblant of what we know works very well for not strongly correlated systems. Namely, if we have systems where we have a small amount of entanglement, which are well described by mean field theory, we know that we can understand the phases of matter, the way in which these systems behave, by looking at the way in which the systems, the symmetries in the systems act locally. So by finding a mean field description and asking how does this mean field description behave with respect to the symmetries present in that system. And of course, the fact that topologically ordered systems have this kind of very complex global entanglement makes it complicated, if at all possible, to describe these systems in a similar way. And the point is that tensor networks form a framework which indeed allows us to give some kind of local description of these systems with a complex amount of entanglement in a way where we kind of combine the physical degrees of freedom, the actual system we want to describe, and the entanglement in that system in a way which allows us to locally model these systems, but also locally understand both conventional and topological order in the way in which the system, the description of the system, transforms under symmetries. And this is what I would like to explain in this talk and illustrate with some examples. And in particular, also, this description allows us to, in a very explicit, a very concrete way, to understand the role of the boundary, the role of entanglement spectra, and so on. So let's get started right away. I guess I don't have to motivate the interest in topologically ordered systems at this workshop. So in order to understand how to describe complex entangled systems, what, from a point of view of entanglement, what we should do is we should ask, what is the structure of the entanglement in these systems? Is there something in their entanglement which makes them special so we can find an efficient description? And this is given by the area law, which tells us that if you look at ground states, or also low energy states of quantum systems, the entanglement in that system will scale, well, not extensively with a volume as we would expect for general quantum states, but these states are very special. Their entanglement will only scale like the boundary of any region. So the entanglement between that region and the rest will just scale like the circumference, which gives rise to an intuition that we should kind of think of as the entanglement, like in this cartoon picture, being distributed only close to the boundary and not much actual long-range entanglement being present in the system. And the question is, can we kind of build an ansatz which captures this intuition in an isotropic way, in a way where each side can be entangled with close-by sides as much as possible and less with more remote sides? And this is the basic intuition behind tensor networks. So what we do is we associate to each side in our lattice. I will focus on spin systems in this talk. Also, these kind of ideas also work for, say, fermionic systems. One can take continuum limits and so on, but I will restrict to lattices of spins, mostly square lattice because they're most easiest to draw. So what we have is that to each site in the system, we associate a five-index tensor. One index is a physical degree of freedom. So if we would do mean field theory, that would be all we need. We would have a vector for each spin describing the state of that spin. Now here we attach four additional indices, so we have some five-index object. And the additional indices are used to correlate, to entangle each site with the adjacent sites. And the way we do this is we connect these indices in a graphical way, building some kind of lattice. And the idea behind this notation is that whenever we connect indices, it means we identify that index and sum over it, so we contract that index. And well, since we contract, say, here over the index gamma, we build up some quantum correlations between the degrees of freedom here and here. So you can imagine that if we start building up the system, what will happen is that we'll sequentially build up entanglement, which will be mostly local. Well, it should be because it's kind of built up through local links, local indices, which we correlate. But of course, potentially, there could also be global entanglement because these guys could correlate in a non-trivial way. So overall, if we wrap this on a torus or we terminate the boundaries in some way, we will get some kind of tensor network which is only left with these physical degrees of freedom. So it will just describe some physical state or, if you wish, a coefficient of the state in some product basis. Now, it turns out that this is actually indeed the right language to describe low energy states of local Hamiltonians, in particular gapped Hamiltonians, but also gapless Hamiltonians to some extent. And that's why it actually forms a powerful basis for numerical methods. But that's not what I would like to talk about. I would like to focus on a different aspect, namely using these states, these ansatz states, to capture kind of the analytical structure or the general structure of strongly correlated systems. So if you want to model physical systems, what are useful properties? Well, one important property which makes us a good framework to model physics is that if we want to encode a system, a wave function, which has some kind of symmetry, then we can do this by really encoding the symmetry into the local tensor. So let's just consider a tensor where we act to some physical symmetry on the physical degree of freedom. And we require that the tensor transforms in a way where we can replace a physical symmetry action by some action on the entanglement. Now we can start building up the network. It's really a local symmetry condition, right? A local condition on how this guy transforms. We can start building up, concatenating these guys, and we'll concatenate these guys. You will see that V meets V dagger. That's a unitary representation. So these guys cancel out, and we can keep growing our system that way. And as we grow our system that way, what you figure out is we put this, say, on a torus. All these transformations on the entanglement degrees of freedom will cancel out. And what we're left with is a system which is indeed, which describes a wave function which is invariant under some on-site, some globally acting on-site symmetry. So this tells us that indeed we can model symmetric wave functions or wave functions with specific symmetries by encoding these symmetries locally. You can easily see that you can, for instance, encode time reversal symmetry, reflection, and so on in a very similar way. And a great thing which makes this a very nice toolbox to study strongly correlated systems is that, well, I told you before, we can use these states to approximate ground states, but we can also do the converse. We can start from such a tensor, from such a local description, and then build a wave function, and at the same time build a Hamiltonian which corresponds to this wave function, which is a parent Hamiltonian for this wave function. And the basic intuition that is that the Hamiltonian takes a small patch, say a 2x2 patch, for instance, and it's built in such a way that it makes sure that the state looks locally like it's built from these tensors. So any state which locally looks like it's built from these tensors is accepted as a ground state, and other states will be high energy states. And well, because it's built from a finite number of objects with a certain symmetry, this Hamiltonian will indeed also carry all these symmetries which we built into this tensor here. So it's really a way to build up a model with certain symmetries. And that's the first message. So we can really use these tensor networks. I actually forgot to mention that they're called projected entangled pair states, or PEPs, I think. So whenever you see PEPs, that's these kind of wave functions. So these wave functions can be used to encode local physics, by which I mean symmetries, structure of the Hamiltonian, and so on, which we kind of deem essential for understanding the physics of a certain systems. We can encode these properties really in a local way. So in some way, they form a framework for constructing solvable models in which not the Hamiltonian is a central object, but the tensor is a central object, and it gives rise to both a Hamiltonian and a wave function on kind of a similar footing, and we encode the relevant properties in this tensor. And well, one example of that kind is the AKLT model, for instance, but we'll see some more in the talk. So one great property of these kind of wave functions is that they give a very explicit meaning to the entanglement in the state. So say we consider a system on some kind of lattice, and we look at a bipartition of our system, and we ask what's the entanglement between the two halves of the bipartition. And what we see is that, well, this entanglement is exactly carried by all these indices crossing that cut, right? Remember, each connected leg is a summation. So we're summing exactly over all these indices. So if we do a decomposition, a Schmidt decomposition of that system, these are exactly the indices carrying the entanglement, and they really carry a one-dimensional structure. There's an explicit Hilbert space corresponding to the entanglement spectrum of the system. So this means that if you want to look at say, an entanglement Hamiltonian, a Hamiltonian describing the entanglement spectrum, we can really explicitly compute a Hamiltonian because we have a one-dimensional Hilbert space, so we really can compute a one-dimensional Hamiltonian for that system without having to compare spectra, so we can directly go and compute this Hamiltonian, and it will inherit all the symmetries from the tensor, so its structure is actually determined to quite some extent just by looking at the overall symmetry structure of the wave function. And so, for instance, what turns out if you do numerical study is that indeed this Hamiltonian, as intuition tells us, is a short-range entangled Hamiltonian with rapidly decaying long-range interactions. So this is some Ising-like model which shows how the interaction strength on a logarithmic scale decays exponentially with the range of the interaction. And for instance, in an AKLT model, the symmetry gives us lots of information. It indeed tells us that basically all the system can do, because the boundary transforms like a spin 1/2, basically it has to be a spin 1/2 Heisenberg type chain up to well longer range terms. Now, what also happens is that this diverges at the phase transition, this entanglement Hamiltonian, which is indeed necessary because we need a diverging correlation length at this point. And well, this could happen through zero temperature, but it turns out it happens through a divergence of the system. That's all things we can check explicitly. And you might wonder what happens in symmetry broken phases, because in this model, which has a symmetry breaking phase transition, we get a long range interaction. But it turns out that's an artifact, because we consider the non-symmetry broken state in the symmetry broken phase. If we fix this, these guys here again start going down once we cross the phase transition, and it becomes shorter and shorter range. Now, you might wonder about topological phases. I will come to that in just a few slides. So one thing we can really study explicitly are entanglement properties of these systems, entanglement Hamiltonians. We can also study edge physics in the sense of cutting the system and asking what is the dynamics of the modes of the degrees of freedom at the edge. And the reason is, again, that the degrees of freedom close to the edge are in one-to-one correspondence with the entanglement degrees of freedom sitting at the boundary, which are marked by red dots. So by imposing different boundary conditions, we modify the physical state close by to the edge, at least if there are exponentially decaying correlations in these systems. That's what we expect. So we can indeed model the edge modes by parameterizing this Hilbert space at the boundary by imposing different boundary conditions. And it turns out that if we look at the parent Hamiltonians, which are basically happy whenever something looks like it's built from the correct tensors, the edge spectrum is special. It's completely flat. But now we can go and study what happens once we put perturbations on the system. And what we find is that indeed these systems can exhibit a very rich physics. So that's actually some results for an AKLT model, which we perturbed with some XXZ and transverse field. And it can show a rich phase diagram with ferromagnetic, antiferromagnetic, and critical phases at the edge through some short-range 1D Hamiltonian at this edge. So again, this really is a concrete way. I didn't write the Hamiltonian, but we can really concretely extract an edge Hamiltonian and then do DMRG simulations. That's what happened here to simulate its phase diagram. Okay, so that's the second message I would like to convey, which is that PEPs provide us with an explicit way to associate a one-dimensional Hilbert space, and by that I don't mean a one-dimensional Hilbert space, but a Hilbert space of a one-dimensional chain. So with a one-dimensional Hilbert space, which really carries the entanglement properties and the edge physics of the system, so we can really explicitly compute Hamiltonians and things like that and density operators. All right, so well, that's kind of the main part of the talk, so let's get to topological order. So before, we were looking at physical symmetries, and physical symmetries were encoded in some local way in the tensor. And now it turns out that topological order can also be encoded through some local property in this tensor, despite it being related to the global order in the wave function. And well, in an abstract form, I will not talk about this abstract form, but I assume Frank will talk about it tomorrow. So in this abstract form, it's related to some kind of Young-Baxter-like equation where some object can be moved through the tensor. But I will illustrate this with more concrete examples, and the example I will mostly use will correspond to Torricot type of order, not only the Torricot wave function, but that kind of order. And the general idea is that there is some Pauli Z, or some more general representation of Z2, so a matrix which is unitary and squares to 1, which I can either contract with the indices here or with the indices here, and this leaves the tensor invariant. So I can think of these guys as being aligned along some line, and this line is being pulled through that tensor. Alternatively, of course, I can multiply the left side with these two Z's, and I get this equation, which tells me that the tensor as such is invariant under multiplying all entanglement degrees of freedom with a Pauli Z, or differently speaking, the entanglement degrees of freedom live in an even parity subspace as a parity constraint, some kind of topological constraint on the entanglement degrees of freedom. I mean, this can be easily generalized by replacing the group Z2 by a general finite group, which actually gives rise to models described by the quantum double models or related to the quantum double models for that group. I will use this for illustration, but if you want, you can always try to have this in mind. And well, as I said, there are more general formulations. Indeed, all string nets can be expressed like that if this object here is defined through the F symbols. Again, I think Frank will say something about that. We can also model chiral wave functions with similar symmetries and explain the chiral order in that. Indeed. So what are the implications of that symmetry? Why is the symmetry interesting, or why is it related to topological order? So let's focus on this condition, which tells us that these Zs kind of can be thought of lying on strings, and these strings can be pushed through the tensor. They can be moved through the tensor. So what we can do then is we can make a long string of these guys, and using this pulling through equation, we can take the string here and move it to the other side, and we can continue doing so, right? So we can think of these Zs, if they lie on a line, as this line kind of floating through our lattice, right? It could be anywhere. Which in particular means that these strings are completely invisible locally, because you cannot, it's not well defined to say they're in a certain position, because you could put them anywhere, right? Because the symmetry in our description. So in particular, if you put a Hamiltonian, say, here, which tries to make sure that the state looks correct, you might argue, oh, there's the string, the state doesn't look correct, but we can move the string, so the Hamiltonian will be happy. So whether we put such a string or we don't put such a string on the system, it will look equally like the original ground state. And this then can be used to parameterize some ground state manifold. So for instance, on a torus, we might put some horizontal string and some vertical string. And for instance, in the case of the group Z2, we would actually parameterize four different ground states on the torus. So we indeed have this topological ground space degeneracy of the toric code. And of course, if you would kind of twist the lattice a bit and put it on a sphere, you can easily see that this is not possible, because any loop then can be deformed to a closed loop. And using this condition, any closed loop can just be removed. Okay, so that's one thing we can do with these strings. The other thing we can do with these strings, which is also related to the topological order, is that we can build excitations. And this can be seen in two different ways. One way to build excitations is to take these strings and to place an open string on the lattice. This open string has two endpoints, which are special because they have an odd number of Zs adjacent to the plaquette. And again, any Hamiltonian acting here will not be able to see that string, because the string can be freely moved. However, the endpoints are special because they have this odd number of Zs. This cannot be changed by the symmetry operation. So these are at least potentially detectable excitations. And well, they come in pairs, so it's very suggestive that they're anions. And well, if that's a toric code, there should be a dual excitation with mutual fermionic statistic. And indeed it exists, and what we need to do to this end is to insert some kind of tensor in some position which does not commute with a string. You remember the whole point was that this string could be freely moved through our tensors. But of course now if you put a different tensor somewhere, say a tensor where we attached a Pauli X, then the string will not commute, because suddenly the string will anti-commute with a Pauli X. So if we try to move that string around that X, we cannot just close the loop and remove the loop as before, but when we try to commute these guys, we get a fermionic minus sign. So indeed, they have a mutual fermionic statistic. So you see, they indeed behave like the excitations in the toric code. And well, this can be generalized indeed to describe general quantum doubles, or well, with more general strings, also stringlet models. And the great thing is that because we work on the virtual level, we can describe excitations even for systems with finite correlation length. So these tensors can very well describe, say, topological models with a finite correlation length. We can still describe anionic excitations as fully localized objects on the entanglement degrees of freedom. Well, if we were to describe them on the physical degrees of freedom, we would kind of have to fatten the string generating them with some exponential envelope, which would be much more complicated. Okay. So with this, I hope I could convince you that indeed the topological order in the system can be understood as arising from such symmetries, so either symmetries of that kind, a parity constraint on the tensor, or rewritten in this form, a pulling through condition. So that's really a way, by looking at the local symmetry in the tensor, making sure that we have some kind, or well, giving us the opportunity to model systems with a certain type of topological order. Now, what are consequences of the symmetry beyond the fact that we can parameterize the ground space and model anions? What are consequences for the entanglement properties of the system? Well, for one thing, if we take the symmetry, very similar to physical symmetries before, just that there's no physical symmetry action, if we take these guys and glue them together, well, there should be a Z, I guess. I wanted to refer to Zs. So if we glue these together to a larger patch, the larger patch will still have entanglement degrees of freedom, which must be invariant under the action of the symmetry. So they must live in the even parity sector, or in the trivial irrep of the symmetry group. And this gives a constraint on the entanglement degrees of freedom in the system. So for instance, this tells us that, well, the entanglement degrees of freedom only occupy half the space, which indeed should give rise to a topological correction in the entanglement entropy. It will also constrain the possible edge physics we can see. If you remember what I told you is that we can model the physical edge physics, so the edge modes of the system, by putting different boundary conditions on the system and thereby imposing states which differ at the edge. However, now the only admissible boundary conditions here, the only ones which are not being mapped to zero, are those which have even parity. So it means that the edge physics is really constrained to the subspace which has even parity, and the system can only evolve in that subspace, and there's no edge dynamics in the odd parity sector, which is indeed a topological protection of the edge. And well, of course, you can get the odd sector if you wish by, well, puncturing, say, that thing, right, and inserting some flux, some non-trivially transforming object, in which case you would get a different sector. Okay, so another consequence is the behavior of the entanglement spectrum. So what do we see in the entanglement spectrum? If we take a bipartition, say, of a long cylinder, what we can do is we have to impose a boundary condition here. Now, usually it shouldn't matter because it's far away, but now what we have, if you think of the symmetries, we concatenate a patch, we know that the joint parity of the left and the right boundary jointly is fixed, which means that by imposing an even or odd parity boundary condition, we get an even or odd parity state for the entanglement. So the overall entanglement spectrum consists of an even and odd parity part with a weight which we can control by choosing an appropriate boundary condition. And this seems like this could be a very non-local Hamiltonian, but what actually happens is that one can show that this Hamiltonian separates into two parts. It has one part which is fully local, it's non-universal, depends on microscopic details, and it has a second part which is universal, which only depends on the topological information in the system, and which basically steers the weight between these two sectors. So this kind of topological temperature here really controls the weight between these two sectors. And while we can also try to insert a flux in that system, and what happens is actually that then this local part will, in addition, couple to a flux. And inserting a flux is, again, nothing but putting a symmetry operation in this along this axis when we close the boundary. So just to illustrate this, is a numerical result for a toric coat with some kind of magnetic field introducing loop tension. And we see that indeed in the topological phase, the interactions in the local part do decay exponentially with the distance up to the phase transition. Whereas if we don't separate these two parts, the total Hamiltonian has a highly non-local part corresponding to this topological contribution here, which is like an n-body interaction. So let me illustrate the use of this with some example. And the first example I would like to discuss is the so-called resonating valence bond state, which is some kind of candidate state for a spin liquid state under Cadomer lattice, and it has been intensely studied. And it consists of a superposition of all possible ways of putting singlets. So each of these blue bars is a singlet of putting singlets under Cadomer lattice. We take an equal weight superposition, so it's resonating, and well, it should be kind of a reasonably good ansatz for a Heisenberg antiferromagnet in that lattice. And it turns out that the state has a very natural description in terms of tensor networks, in terms of PEPs. In fact, one could argue it's the most simple SU2 invariant PEPs one could choose, because if you want that our tensor is invariant under a spin 1/2 transformation, it turns out we have to mix integer and half-integer representations here. That's the only way to get a half-integer representation here. And the simplest way of doing it is mixing spin 0 and spin 1/2. And then the simplest way of building a tensor with that property is to just entangle through a singlet the physical spin 1/2 and one of the auxiliary ones. And if we symmetrize this, we get exactly that wave function. Now, in order to understand the physics of this wave function, it's kind of a tricky thing, and the reason that it's tricky is mostly that all these singlet configurations we have are not orthogonal, so it's very hard to kind of sample from that state to study that state, because all these singlets form loops, and all these overlaps of these loops have different weights depending on the number of loops and the length of the loops. So it's very hard to assess its nature, so what people did is they intensely studied dimer models, where they replaced the singlets by orthogonal dimers, because these can be analytically mapped to fixed-point wave functions, in particular the toric coat wave function. And one can really exactly solve for that model, but it's not so easy to relate these two models in a rigorous way. And so what we did using tensor networks is we built a tensor network interpolation between the RVB state and the dimer model, which has a smooth Hamiltonian coming with it. And the reason this works is basically what we do is that the RVB tensor, it has a SU2 symmetry, which is a physical symmetry, and at the same time a topological Z2 symmetry. And basically, we built an interpolation where we take away the SU2 symmetry, and we are left with something which only has a Z2 symmetry and is a fixed point wave function. And thereby, we basically can get rid of the kind of problematic part of the system and stay with the topological part. And what we found along this interpolation is that really, that's on the next slide. Okay, so how did we study this interpolation? Well, it turns out we can take our system, wrap it on a cylinder, and cut it into slices. And then for each of these slices, we can ask how much correlations are kind of carried over from one slice to the next. It's basically a transfer operator formalism. And the great thing is that this doesn't bound only the decay of a specific correlation function, it bounds the decay of any correlation function in the system, both topological sector correlations and any kind of complicated object correlations. So unlike many other methods, we can basically bound the decay of any kind of, well, singlet-singlet, quadrupole-quadrupole, et cetera, correlation through a single number. And it turns out if we look at the spectrum of this transfer operator, well, this number to the power of the distance tells us how correlations decay. And well, we see everything is far bounded away from one, correlations decay very quickly. And the green lines here correspond to overlaps between topological sectors, or if you wish, anion-anion correlation functions. So the fact that these are bounded away from one tells us that the topological order in the system is not destroyed along the interpolation. And the blue line is a spin, well, is a topologically trivial correlation function, so any kind of spin-spin, whatever correlation function. And all of these also stay finite. So the system really doesn't exhibit any long-range order, so it's really a spin liquid. So this really unambiguously resolves the fact that it's a topological spin liquid. And just in case, since this is very sketchy, so that's a leading eigenvector here with a thorough finite size scaling, and you see it's really very accurate and converges very well for these systems. And I should also say that using analytical methods that take some work, one can indeed not only connect these states, but also look at the Hamiltonian and really prove that the corresponding Hamiltonian has exactly a fourfold, that one obtains a Hamiltonian which has the exact ground state, the RVB state has an exact ground state, and which is exactly topologically fourfold degenerate. Okay, how much time is left?
Seven,
okay, good, that's great. All right, so I guess then there's still some time to look at entanglement spectra if we have 7 minutes. So we can now also use the toolbox we had previously to look at the entanglement properties of the RVB state. And well, as I told you previously, if we want to understand the entanglement properties, we can, or the entanglement Hamiltonian, it's very helpful to think about symmetries. And well, the symmetry in this case, as I told you before, has a spin zero space and a spin one half space. So we can think of this as spin up, spin down in the vacuum. And it has SU2 symmetry. So it's very similar to the TJ model, except that we can also have pairing terms. And if we study it numerically, we indeed find that the entanglement Hamiltonian is approximately local, interactions decay exponentially. The dominant terms are Hopping and indeed also a pairing term, and then there are also Heisenberg terms and so on. And well, the longer range term suggests it's actually bosonic and not fermionic. But well, why fermionic? Well, there's a topological symmetry, a Z2 symmetry, so there is indeed a superselection rule in the Hamiltonian, which is some parity conservation. All right. Let me skip that. Well, that's just to say we can also compute kind of dispersion relations by parametrizing the different anions through the correlation functions in the system. If you want, you can ask me later. But let me just spend the last 5 minutes talking about a different question, namely how we can model different topological phases in this framework and how we can understand the transition between them through anion condensation and how we can map this to one-dimensional phases, one-dimensional SPT phases. And well, I apologize for the different pictures, but these are still the tensors. And if you remember how we modeled topological excitations, what we did is we had string-like operators which corresponded to group actions. And then in addition, we could put endpoints either separately or combined, which would transform like irreducible representations of the symmetry group. Now, my claim initially was that this kind of describes an anion, but in the end, it's a bit more subtle because, of course, the string here experiences some environment which is imposed by the remaining part of the wave function. And in the thermodynamic limit, there could be some emergent behavior, which is, well, maybe not what we expect from the finite behavior. So what could actually happen? Well, it could, for instance, happen that this boundary condition is orthogonal, this environment is orthogonal to the string. So in that case, basically, we get zero. So this doesn't really describe a free anion, so we should assume that this anion, in fact, is confined in such a model. The other thing which can happen is that this environment in some way absorbs the string. The string is an eigenstate, well, the environment is an eigenstate of the string. So the string just vanishes, and we get the same state back, in which case it actually doesn't describe an excitation, but still the ground state. So we would assume that this kind of excitation became condensed in that case. So how can we understand what happens? Well, in pictures, one thing we should look at is the overlap of a state with an anion, with a state without an anion. The other one, confinement, is something like the normalization of the anion. Is it well normalized or not? Now, except that in one case I have a single layer string, in one case I have a double layer string, it's pretty much the same picture. So let's just consider this one and assume these strings might be different. So what happens if you want to evaluate these kind of condensation or confinement order parameters for such a system? Well, we put this on an infinite system, and we should take the fixed point from the left and the fixed point from the right and evaluate this doubled Ketbra string operator in the fixed point coming from left and right. And so what is this? It's really a string order parameter evaluated in a one-dimensional system in the end, right? So there should be a way to understand what this guy here does through the behavior of string order, of SPT order, symmetry breaking, anything detected by string order parameters in one-dimensional systems. And, well, how does this work? Well, we should cut this guy here in slices, and then we get this operator here, which is a transfer operator of the system. And it turns out that this transfer operator, because each tensor has some symmetry, it inherits these symmetries. And because, well, the tensor has a pure entanglement symmetry, we get independent symmetries acting on the Ket layer, on the Bra layer. So if the original symmetry group was G, we have a new group which is G times G. So this is an operator with a local, or well, on-site global symmetry, with symmetry group G times G. And we're looking for the structure of its fixed point, which in some sense is like a ground state of a Hamiltonian, conceptually, more or less. So in the end, so again, we have something which is kind of like a Hamiltonian, hopefully. It has a symmetry G times G, and we want to look for its phase diagram, so whatever we can detect with order parameters or with string order parameters. And it turns out that indeed, if we want to classify the anion behavior, what one has to do is to really look at the classification of 1D phases of this doubled symmetry group G times G. And this really involves two questions. It involves, first of all, symmetry breaking, and then looking for the unbroken symmetry and asking, is there possibly a symmetry protected phase? And this allows us to classify all ways in which these anions ultimately can behave in these systems and design transitions between them. And just to show some results for, well, the simplest kind of non-trivial case, which is starting from a Z4 symmetry. What we can do is we can start from a Z4 symmetry. There are different ways to break it. But there's one interesting case, namely, if the overall symmetry is Z4 times Z2, it turns out that there are two different phases possible, and one is a toricode and one a double semion. And the only way to distinguish them is basically through symmetry protected order in that state. And while one can play with the symmetry and explore this full phase diagram of the system, and well, one gets really a rich phase diagram with this full Z4 symmetry, two different toricodes, in fact, trivial phases, double semion phases, and well, we can really compute order parameters for these transitions. So that's from the Z4 to the toricode. This is not so surprising, maybe, that it maps to an Ising model. This is the condensation transition from the double semion to the trivial one, and to be honest, we have no idea what kind of universality class this is. So these are the order parameter critical exponents. So if anyone knows what the universality class that is, please let me know. And yeah, we can also study the phase transition between the two topological phases, toricode and double semion, which is possibly not explained by condensation. And indeed, depending on how we interpolate, we find different orders. We find first order transitions as well as second order transitions. So this is really kind of a nice toolbox to play with these transitions and explore these transitions. And with this, I guess I'm out of time. And fortunately, I'm at the end. Let me just put up the summary and stop here. Thanks.
Questions?
So as nice as tensors are for topological order, mm-hmm. they're also highly unstable, as in even a small local perturbation in your, like numerical perturbation in your initial tensor might end up representing a state which is completely different from your topological state.
But that's true for any variational method, right? Leon actually has a paper on that. I mean, the point is that any variational method, well, whenever you try to, you're energetically very close to the ground state, but the energy density, which is what you minimize, is any epsilon above the ground state, say in the Torrey code. What does it mean? Well, it means that you have an epsilon doping with some kind of excitations, either electric or magnetic. So you have these fluctuating electric backgrounds. So as soon as you look at a volume, which is 1/ε or so, you have a fluctuation on the order of 1 electric excitation, which automatically destroys the topological order. But that's true for any variational method, and probably even for non-variational methods if you go to low temperatures or so. So what you have to do is you have to be careful with the scales at which you look, right? You will see that the entropy has a topological correction, hopefully, for large enough scales. And if you go really big, it will jump and it will go away. But well, you have to be careful in these cases. Now, if you model things analytically, it's much nicer because you can ensure that the symmetry is there. Or even if you do numerics, you could actually ensure that the symmetry is there. And this whole idea of anion condensation indeed tells you that you can model different topological phases by fixing a single symmetry. So it's not that by pinning the symmetry, you kind of force your system to be in that phase and it cannot kind of model a different phase.
For more complicated example, it's clear what the symmetry is. Like for Torrey code, it's just C2.
Well, I was a bit simplistic, right, because I didn't want to explain the complicated thing. Well, I mean, you can go to groups for doubles, right? And in the more general case, you have these pulling through equations, which I had in an earlier slide, where there's some kind of more general algebraic. So basically, the difference is that when you pull these guys through from left to right, there's a correlation between the different symmetry actions. So they're themselves described by a tensor network, say a matrix product operator, which then, say, in string net models is given by the F symbol of the model. I'm not sure if Frank will talk about it, but I suspect he will. He's nodding, so he will talk about it.
So could you be a bit more explicit when you talked about this pulling through condition? So is that a specific ansatz for the actual matrices UG that you put on your ansatz? In other words, it's still puzzling, you know, that intuitively the long range entangled phases should not be easily described by kind of local picture that you provided. So what do you do in the end? You introduce those strings or loops that are technically invisible, but you average over all possible such loops configurations. So how do you actually capture it technically?
Technically you want to choose a tensor which has a symmetry condition, which of course if you take a random tensor it will never have it. It's a very special condition if you wish, but it's locally ensured, right? Basically I'm saying this tensor transforms trivially under a certain symmetry action, so it's in the trivial irrep. It just happens that the symmetry action only acts on the entanglement degrees of freedom. The physical system is never involved, which indeed relates to the fact that it's not related to a physical symmetry, at least away from the fixed point. It's not related to an actual local physical symmetry in your system. But it is a local condition on these tensors. It's just telling me that the entanglement is constrained to a certain subspace. And if you have this loop picture in mind for whatever string net models or Torrey code, the idea of the loop picture is that it's a local condition to have this loop. It's kind of, say for Z2, indeed related exactly to the fact that these loops are preserved. There's some kind of Gauss law for these loops. And this is neither reflected on even very large scales in the fact that, you know, you always cut an even number of loops independent of how big the regions you cut. But it is ensured by a local condition. So it's kind of similar to that.
So in practice, you're searching in a subspace of possible tensors such that satisfy this condition. And that's all that's necessary to...
That's indeed. I mean, if you want to systematically, say, explore all topological models with a certain dimension, you would fix that. You would constrain yourself in that symmetric subspace and then search for tensors. You can also more explicitly try to construct a model. Say, if you want to construct an SU2 invariant model with the smallest one dimension, there are not so many options. You get nearest neighbor RVBs, you get longer range RVBs. If you add some phases, they can become chiral, but the families are relatively small you get in that case. So it depends a bit on your purpose, whether you want to do a brute force numerical optimization or you want to build small families where you kind of know what's going on and play with parameters.
So when you go through a phase transition, and you're building your Hamiltonian using this parent Hamiltonian construction, can you be sure that when you go through that you're not fine-tuning somehow?
Well it's obviously fine-tuned because it's a specific line along which we're interpolating.
No, but that's not what I meant. I meant, are you capturing somehow the universal features of that phase transition, or are you fine-tuning
It's a bit tricky, probably. If you want to do it variationally, probably it's a better method to actually also allow to perturb your tensor away from some which have this symmetry. Uh-huh. I mean, if you're given a specific Hamiltonian. I mean, these Hamiltonians you get by looking at a specific interpolation are obviously fine-tuned. And certainly for those models where we can map them to classical model, to some known models, they tend to map to 2+0 models and not 2+1 models.
Uh-huh.
But you know, you kind of relax that by basically doing a variational approach where you allow to break the symmetry given the topological order, and what you will see is that indeed around the phase transition where it should be, it will be more favorable to use a tensor which does not have that symmetry. It's kind of, in some sense, a bit wasteful to use a tensor which has a topological symmetry to describe a non-topological system. It's a bit like using using something which has a GHZ type symmetry to describe a symmetry broken, classical symmetry broken system like an Ising model. Because you're using entanglement to kind of entangle the all up spin state with the all down spin state, but you're not really using it, right? Because it's energetically not favorable. So that's why at that point, if you want to more accurately reproduce the physics, you should also consider tensors which break the symmetry. If you actually want to variationally study a Hamiltonian with these
models. And what about like the other not the states that are non you can't describe by a tensor, those things matter at the phase transition?
Well, I mean, indeed, the whole framework is better suited to study phases and phase transitions, that's quite likely, right? Because it's certainly better suited to study gap phases because there's less entanglement. So you have to be more careful towards phase transitions. If you actually want to get the critical exponents, you have to extrapolate in your bond dimension and so on. So that's indeed what you have to do if you want to do full numerical studies.
Right, but it seems conceivable you couldn't do that.